Blog Talk Radio.
This is JJ Bomber. You are listening to Well Armed Radio.
Good evening, sheepdogs. Welcome to Well Armed Radio, where freedom is our best friend. Thank you for joining us in our weekly vigorous, relentless, and occasionally ruthless pursuit of freedom. We are broadcasting live from the very Well Armed studio in New Berlin, Wisconsin. It's my pleasure to speak with the most informed gun owners in the state. That would be you guys. You are your community's finest. With a face for radio and a voice for silent movies, my name is Nick Clark. I'm the president of Wisconsin Carry and the host of Well Armed Radio. And as I've mentioned in weeks before, I'm just a free man trying to stay afloat in the sea of communism. Encourage you to be part of the show tonight with your calls, ideas, questions, comments, criticism, participation, 646. That's the old number. When I, the new number, 563-999-3787, 563-999-3787. Start the show with the usual warning, no sacred cows here. And we'll do it. I'll say first 50 minutes of the show is open line with your chance to call anything you'd like to discuss. That said, it's 8:35 on Sunday evening. There's a professional sporting contest going on in the town of Green Bay, the city of Green Bay, Wisconsin. And I expect that everybody's tuned into something other than Well Armed Radio. So for those of you who catch this on the podcast, thanks for tuning in whenever you do catch the show. And I'll be lucky, I think, if I see a live listener pop in here to the chat tonight, but you never know. Luck may be on my side. So here we are. Happy New Year. Happy 2022. You know, last couple of years, just I start this with the everybody knows what's happened the last couple of years, but think about January of 2020. So that's 2 years ago today. Trump was in office. Economy was booming. Things were good. I mean, it was just one of the greatest economies in the history of our country. You know, I can't speak for like the roaring 20s or something like that. But I mean, in modern history, I mean, it was just a phenomenal economy, tremendously low unemployment. You know, you could buy things. Things were it was a great time to be an American. And then, you know, you start hearing about COVID. And we all know what's happened. But here's the thing I want to say is, you know, I'm not a scientist, not an epidemiologist, but I got a brain. And back in March of 2020, I mean, just all the things that started happening and that they were saying and that we and I wasn't the only one, but just so many of us knew. But it's just amazing to see where this country has gone in the span now of 2 years. And I say 2 years, I mean, it went there in the span of a year because this last year has just been more of the same. Everything I called it a 50-year leap. We went from, you know, I won't even call it the slide to socialism. I'll call it the sprint to communism. We took a 50-year leap forward in 2020 from being a somewhat free country, and I would say even an arguably more free country than we had been, certainly a more free country than we had been under Barack Obama, but a country with secure borders, a country with all kinds of things going for it, roaring economy. And the thing is, when you judge freedom, I've always wondered, like, how do you judge how free you are? I mean, you know, what one law, one imposition on your rights doesn't make you not free, but what determines a free society? And as I thought about that, I used to think that, you know, maybe a measure of how free a society would be the percentage of the economy that was private sector spending versus the percentage of the economy that was public sector spending, because that would be somewhat of a measure. And what we, you know, I think the percentage of all spending that had been government spending had been growing and growing, growing over time. And then there was going to be an inflection point where government spending was going to be 50% of all spending, all GDP. And that, I think you could say, would be a tipping point from when you go from being a free country to not a free country, where you'd be a command and control country type thing. But then we had the stolen election, and I came to the conclusion that, look, without free and fair elections, that's it right there. We're not a free country. So I call it the post-constitutional America that we're in now. You know, I still think we're over the edge. We're over the cliff of socialism, communism, but you know, we're hanging by a rope. You know, we'll see what happens in the next year or two, if we can propel ourselves back up over the cliff of communism. And and that's what I was going to do this segment of the show on tonight, the first segment here of the show is to start off and really, and thanks Ralph from Pleasant Prairie for popping in tonight. Great to have you in. Really to, and now I have to ask Ralph, are you in Pleasant Prairie or are you in Florida? Cause I know Ralph likes to pop back to Florida. I think Ralph's a sunbird, snowbird, not a sunbird, snowbird. So Ralph, great to have you in. But I wanted to start this off because we conservatives, we freedom-minded folks, we, you know, whatever, however you want to term yourself, you know, we've taken our licks the preceding 2 years. I mean, we have taken it on the chin. We've had elections stolen. We've been canceled. I've been depersoned, deplatformed from social media. And that was extremely hard. I mean, I didn't think when I first got banned from Facebook, fascist book, on November election night, November 3rd, 2020, I thought, my first thought was, well, I'm going to have a lot more free time. I'm going to have a lot more time to get stuff done. And honestly, that's been true because there was a lot of days where I spent a good portion of the day on social media, on Facebook. When I go to the gym, I work out, and well, if my fiance's there, but in between sets, I talk to her. But if she's not there in between sets, I grab my phone, check Facebook. I mean, there was, you know, you got so many friends. There's something new every 5 minutes, something to look at. Your Facebook feed was fresh. You could, you know, and you never even made it through. I mean, I remember when I first got on Facebook back in 2008, and I had 50 friends, 50, you know, friends on Facebook. You know, I could read everything. I could read everything that my 50 friends had posted, because every day there was maybe 5 or 10 things. And so you read until you saw what you, the last thing that you remember reading from the day before, and you saw everything. And of course, then as Facebook grows and grows, and then all of a sudden you got, I think at one point I was up to 900 friends before I did a massive, massive friend purge. And I didn't want people on there who I wasn't didn't know personally. A lot of Wisconsin Carry members who had friended me, and again, nothing personal. I wanted a little bit of privacy back on Facebook. So I realized that there's a lot of Wisconsin Carry members that I just didn't know at all. And then, so I think then I got down to 450, 475 friends that I was down to, but still, always some fresh information on there. So then you also realize how hard it is to keep in touch with people when you're not on Fascist Book, you know, friends, and you think, oh, I keep, no, it's not, it's difficult to keep in touch. So it really did feel like being depersoned. I mean, there's friends who I haven't talked to since then. Some of them I've connected with on LinkedIn, but nobody checks LinkedIn. You know, that's a business thing. I'm on Instagram not because I wanted to be, because it was the only thing I could get on, because I was banned from Fascist Book. But so that was super tough. So we conservatives, we've been banned, censored, deplatformed, you name it. And then we've had our, you know, not me personally, but I'm speaking in general, businesses shut down and lockdowns and forced to wear masks. I've never worn one. The communist face diaper of obedience has not been on my face one time, not a single time, not for 1 second. But, you know, many people have. I mean, if I had to fly, you know, I would have had no choice. Fortunately, I haven't had to fly in the last 2 years. A couple of times when I could have, I just drove instead. Someplace is Minneapolis. Sometimes I'd fly to Minneapolis. Sometimes I drive. But it's just, you know, we conservatives, we freedom-minded folks, we've taken it on the chin the last couple of years. And I mean, we've taken it on the chin. We've taken it, you know, taken a shot to the below the belt. I mean, it's been rough, but I'm here to tell you that I think 2022 is going to be the year of winning. And I want you to get ready for it, because we're going to win again. Freedom is going to win again. It's time. Freedom is going to be on a roll. And I'm not just blowing sunshine up your ass. I see the pathway, the mechanisms, the pathway for 2022 to be the year of winning. And I don't think, and it's going to be a ramp up to winning. I think the real winning is going to come when Trump is reelected president. I think then we're going to have, you're going to see winning like you've never seen. I think Trump is going to be, and again, I would love to see a Trump DeSantis ticket. That's 12 years of swamp busting. DeSantis isn't ready to hit the ground running. Remember how much trouble Trump had in his first term? Well, he only had one term. At the beginning of his first term, getting the right people on his cabinet, massive turnover. He didn't know who he could trust. You know, that bleepity bleep Jeff Sessions, who appoints to, nominates to head the Department of Justice. And he is a massive disappointment. So I think Trump now knows who he can trust, who he can't. And for that reason, Trump's ready to hit the ground running day one, more prepared than any other president in the history of the country, because he's already been president once. And DeSantis, who I think is a freedom, what's the word? A champion of freedom, a true champion of freedom. And he's in your face. I think DeSantis is an awesome pick for VP. And I think DeSantis would be a shoe-in for president. And we would see freedom, a restoration of freedom like we've never seen before. And wins for wins for freedom. And I don't even want to say wins for conservatives, but I say wins for freedom because when conservatives are at their best, it's when they act and advocate for freedom. Because freedom has a solution to all this. Freedom has a solution. Lon from Wausau just popped into the chat. Great to have you here with us tonight. That's Lon and Ralph, that's two more people live listenership than I thought I was going to have tonight with the Packer game going on. Although I guess with a 20 point lead, maybe people feel like they can turn the volume down in the Packer game and listen to Well Armed Radio here. But so 2022, I truly genuinely believe is going to be the year of winning. I've said it in the past. I'm saying it again, and I'm saying it multiple times because I'm going to be right on this one. So I want to review 2020. Excuse me, 2020. Let's just go back to where the losing. 2020 came in with the boom. The economy was soaring. And when the economy was soaring in 2020, let's say January 2020, it wasn't because of government programs. It wasn't because of new entitlements. It was because of free markets. It was because of elimination of regulations. And so we had the best economy we've ever had, and we had the lowest unemployment we've ever had. We had rising wages. Remember after the Trump tax cut, we had rising incomes and without inflation. We've got rising incomes now, but inflation is rising faster than incomes. But during Trump's, remember all the bonuses? Remember when the tax cuts went into place and all the bonuses? You know, there was a company, $2,000 an employee across the board, every employee in the company. $2,000 bonuses. That was Trump's economy. And again, that was without any programs. That was without any stimulus. $2,000 bonuses to every employee. That was just from the tax cuts. And then along with that, people had more money to spend. But with full employment, we could produce it. We could produce these products. We could now with all this COVID stimulus, there was money injected. People weren't working. So there's more money and fewer products because products weren't being produced to the same extent and the growth of production of products. So there was more money, less goods and services to purchase. That's textbook recipe for inflation. And we've seen it, massive inflation. So, you know, it's 2020 came in with a boom, soaring economy, not because of government programs, not because of entitlements, because of free markets. And then COVID hits. And again, when I say COVID hits, it wasn't the COVID. It was the government reaction. And if you want to see anything, and government never admits it's wrong, but like look at now. I mean, if you want to see any proof positive that the government was wrong, we've got more COVID right now. We've got more cases right now, more you know, it's among the worst that it's been, not necessarily with hospitalizations, but with cases and the surge. And if lockdowns were justified, which they weren't, lockdowns don't work, but they would have been more justified right now than they would have been in March, April of 2020. So the fact that we're not closing stuff and locking stuff down now proves that the government, without admitting it, realizes that lockdowns were a mistake. So this wasn't COVID that did this. This was the government reaction to COVID that did this. The government got virtually everything wrong. So then think about the lockdowns. Think about the businesses destroyed, the people that were in the restaurant business, just their life's work destroyed, mandates, ruling by emergency decree, you know, Tony Evers being one example. I mean, and the thing about emergency powers is anything that lasts more than a week is not an emergency. I mean, an emergency must be, in order for something to be an emergency, it has to be important and serious and then also urgent. Because if it's just something that's important/serious, if it's something that's serious but not urgent, not an emergency. Something would have to be, excuse me, it's only an emergency when you have something that's very serious and imminent, urgent. If you have something that's serious but not urgent, it's not an emergency. If you have something that's urgent but not serious, that's not an emergency. It has to be both of those things. An emergency really should only be there when the time in government for government power purposes, when the time to convene normal governing bodies doesn't exist. And in today's day and age, with today's technology, I mean, that should be like a week. And okay, let's remember the legislative process is slow. So let's say like 30 days. Like there should be nothing, no emergency powers of any governmental body should be able to go more than 30 days. Because in 30 days, you can convene a legislature, you can get people in, you can get the public hearings, the whatever. You can. So regardless of what should or shouldn't justify an emergency, there should be no emergencies that any emergency powers in anything that go beyond 30 days. Because once you get past the, you know, to that point, you can convene a legislative body. You can convene an elected representative government and make decisions through the legislative process, not through emergency dictate. And so one of the things that I hoped for when they started with these was that all of these emergency power seizures would result in changes to the emergency powers. And in some states they have. Some states, Wisconsin not being one of them, because we've got Governor Skeletor in place. But many states have changed their laws with regard to emergency powers. But again, think about 2020. And this applies to 2022 as well. 2021, excuse me. The death of science. The death of science in terms of specifically with COVID and specifically with how we deal with public health issues, it's been virtually dictated by big pharma and Democrats. And I mean, think about this, how we've seen medicine exposed as an arm of big pharma and as an arm of Democrats. I would have never thought there'd come a point in my life where I would have lost faith in the health system in this country. And I've lost faith in the health system in this country. I used to think if you went to the hospital, and I'm not joking, I'm not doing this for hyperbole and exaggeration. I used to think when you went to the hospital, they would do everything they could to save your life. I no longer believe that. And I mean, when I say no longer believe it, not even a tiny bit. COVID has proved to me that all they care about is, and it's, I don't want to say all they care about is money because that's too generic. But it's true. You've got big pharma, Pfizer, Moderna, who've become some of the most largest market capitalization companies in the world because of COVID. And you've got how they've gotten in bed with, and I hate even to use these kinds of cliches because it's so much more rational, not rational is not the right word, it's so much more factual. It's so much more documentable what's happened here. But everybody has just gone lockstep, whether it's for liability reasons or for whatever. You've got these hospitals who the government says stop doing elective procedures, boom, they stop doing elective procedures. The government says this, boom, they stop doing this. And I think it got worse when Tony Evers came in because, but use the example of ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, these treatments for COVID. When you have hospitals like Aurora saying that, because it's one thing like, you know, you thought the doctor-client relation, again, this I'm talking about this exposure of medicine as an arm. Medicine has been exposed as a big bureaucratic arm of, again, big pharma and Democrats in government. The CDC and everything that's been put in place since COVID came down the pipe has exposed, and again, if it wasn't that way before, it's become that way. It's become a situation where big pharma and the Democrats literally run every medical institution in this country, every hospital. I can't say every hospital, but almost every hospital, certainly every large hospital system, Aurora, Bellin, Beaumont. That's, I think Michigan is Beaumont. but these Aurora Advocate, I should say, these large healthcare systems, they're very heavy administration down. They're not medicine based. They're administration based. And if the CDC goes to these hospital administrators at these mega hospital companies, Aurora Advocate, Advocate Aurora, Ascension, and they say, thou shalt do this, those companies did it. Why did those companies do it last year? Well, they had to do it because they were scared of COVID. They were shutting down. They weren't doing elective procedures. People were stopping, you know, going to the ERs. You know, people weren't coming into the ER. It was, people were afraid to go to a medical facility until they were sick, of course. But the hospitals needed to get down at the altar of government because they got massive, massive cash influxes from the government. And so in order to, if they weren't, if that power structure, if that power control wasn't there before COVID, it certainly, and maybe it was, we just don't know, but it was certainly put in place now with COVID, to where, you know, the CDC and bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. can dictate how all these hospitals work. Aurora Advocate comes out a couple months ago and says, no doctor in our system can prescribe ivermectin for COVID. Then they went further and said, our pharmacies will not fill prescriptions for ivermectin for COVID. They'll fill them because you can use ivermectin as a treatment for like scabies and stuff like that. So you can fill it if that's the, you know, if you have scabies, they'll fill a prescription. But if you have, if you want to use ivermectin for COVID, Aurora's pharmacies at the administrative level said, we will not allow this. That's insane. If a doctor within Aurora, that's the administration telling every doctor how they have to practice. Do you realize that there is no longer a practice of medicine? There is a bureaucracy of medicine, a hierarchy of medicine. And then everything becomes following protocols. Oh, the protocol is this. The CDC protocol is this. The FDA protocol is this. The FDA protocol for treating COVID is this. And no one will go off protocol. Well, that's great if the protocol was genuine, solution-based. But the protocols are politically based. The protocols are based on, I mean, they put everything in the, you know, initially they said, oh, it's going to take 5 to 10 years to develop a vaccine. Then all of a sudden the people in these vaccine companies realized, hey, wait a minute. We have a $1 trillion, multi-trillion dollar golden goose here. Here, Lon says, my son just bought ivermectin over the counter. Lon, I'm curious where he got it. I got a prescription for ivermectin. I had to do it over mail order, though. I was reading some stuff like ivermectin is such a great drug. Ivermectin should be available like Tylenol. Oh, he's out of the country. So yeah, ivermectin, I've heard it's just got tremendous antiviral properties and it's super cheap. And you sit here and you talk about like, I think even for, I've heard and read, and I've been doing a lot of research on it, that ivermectin is even good for, you know, influenza. So here you've got influenza. I mean, we could potentially have a treatment that would severely mitigate the effects of the flu virus, which is one of the leading killers of people year over year over year over year going back decades in this country. And you've got the Tamiflu, which is super expensive, but the Tamiflu like that, you have to take it within, you know, 24 hours or 48 hours of onset of symptoms for Tamiflu to work. Those are the big pharma solutions. But like nobody wants to, like, because ivermectin is available as a generic, it's off name brand, it's off patent. There's no big money to be made in it. There's little money to be made in it. When I say little money, I don't mean little money, but there's, what do they call it? Cash cows, terminology for something that's a little more of a producer, but There's a business term for a product that's, you know, at the lower part of its life cycle, but it's a sustaining revenue generator, not a blockbuster anymore, but just a little. I can't remember the word for it. It's not. Maybe it is cash cow. I feel like there was another business term that we used to use for a product that's, you know, past that large growth state. It's not a growth cycle product. It's not a product that's growing. It's just a product that continues to pay, you know, dividend. Again, it's not like dividend dog or something like that. But anyway, but ivermectin, I mean, I think that for use, even for stuff like influenza, we could have a tremendous therapeutic there for even the flu. It doesn't prevent the flu, but it just makes the flu a lot easier to live with. And yeah, I've even heard that for colds and viruses, it could be. It should be. I saw someone on the that was doing a paper on this said that that ivermectin should be. It's such a great drug with so few contraindications, so few side effects that they really and for how useful it would be for so many ailments, it should be able to be gone off and bought off the shelf just like Tylenol. And in fact, Tylenol, because Tylenol can be so hard on, I think your liver and kidneys is what Tylenol can be really hard on. But Tylenol is more of a danger for, you know, you take too much Tylenol, you can seriously mess up your organs. So yeah, of course, if you overdose on ivermectin, yeah, that could be bad for you too. But again, just like Tylenol, there's plenty of over-the-counter medications. There's plenty of over-the-counter medications that would be seriously bad for you if you take too much of them. So that's no reason not to have it over-the-counter. But so yeah, just the death of science, the exposure of medicine is an arm of big pharmaceutical and Democrats, hospitals that just because they need the money from the federal government, because they have, you know, agreements with big pharmaceutical companies that they just follow whatever their dictate is. And then the dictate has turned out to be vaccine or bust. And again, it's not even a vaccine, but COVID shot or bust. So you've got that with all that COVID crap. You got the stolen election, the death of free speech, big tech tyranny. And again, I told you how hard it was to be banned from a fascist book. Super, super hard, even with Wisconsin Carry. I mean, Wisconsin Carry had 12,000 members on the Facebook group. I could get in touch with people all over the state in a moment's notice. And granted, some of our people on our board of directors are still on Facebook, but I can't, you know, I'm not going to go to Oric every time I need something post. Maybe two or three times a day I would go post something. I'm not going to email Oric two or three times a day, hey, post this. It's just, you know. So it's been difficult to utilize Wisconsin Carry. On a side note, I've got locally here in New Berlin, I've got something called the New Berlin Taxpayers Alliance, which is a local activist group that I ran and still run. I've found a workaround for that. I got, when I got banned from fascist book, I bought the website, newberlintaxpayersalliance.org. I have developed a mailing list off of that. So now I've bypassed Facebook and I can actually now reach more people than I used to reach with the New Berlin Taxpayers Alliance Facebook group. But friends and family, even, you know, doing business, it's difficult with this big tech tyranny. Many entities release info on Facebook, like news stations, weather stations, local government, law enforcement agencies. I mean, even places that I like, I'm looking at a travel trailer. Oliver Trailers is a travel trailer I'm looking at. Fletcher's gun shop here in Waukesha and Pewaukee, they're ours. I mean, it just, Facebook was often more up to date, more easy to get information. And when you're banned from Facebook, you don't realize how it's really, really hard to function efficiently. Something that used to, you know, it's, some people refer to being banned from Facebook as being depersoned to a large extent. It's hard to crowdsource information. Something that used to be an easy question, ask your Facebook group. I used to call it the Facebook brain. Or ask in the Wisconsin Carry group. There was, you know, although of the 12,000 some people, I mean, there was, I think it was about 10% that would see any given post. So 12,000 people, maybe 1,000 people would see a particular post. But that's still 1,000 people that someone's going to know the answer to your question. If I said, hey, is anybody in Jackson County? Boom, within 20 minutes, I probably had someone on Facebook. It was very useful for Wisconsin Carry. But then, again, we're reviewing how shitty 2020, 2021 was. The economic woes brought on by government. And it was all brought on by government. It couldn't be more true. I mean, Ronald Reagan once said it, government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the source of them. And that just couldn't be more true. So, I mean, all the stuff that we've, the lies, the courts that would refuse to, and then people saying, oh, there's no evidence of vote fraud. No, there's evidence everywhere of vote fraud. Is there proof of vote fraud? Well, the only way I believe so, but proof is a legal term. Proof comes in the form of a judgment. Proof comes in the form of a verdict. Proof comes in the form of a judgment from a judge. We've never gotten to that point. We've never litigated these cases. All we've done is had the cases refused to be heard, these vote fraud cases. So, everything from being referred to as domestic terrorists. I mean, just we've taken on the chin. We've been had to suffer every kind of indignity and loss that we could possibly think of over the past 2 years. But again, I'm here to say 2022 is going to be the year of winning. The 2022 midterms, there's now I say this and I think to myself, Nick, don't jinx it, because there is so much dissatisfaction with Democrats right now that there's not enough vote fraud in the world to overcome the margin of victory that Republicans are going to have. Then I think to myself, Nick, don't underestimate Democrats, because they'll, when you think there would have to be more, they'd have to manufacture more votes than there were people in a district. Then I think, well, wait, they already did that in 2020. It already occurred in 2020 that there was some places where the vote turnout drastically exceeded the number of registered voters. And they said, oh, same day registration, something, they made up lies to justify it. So again, I don't, many of these congressional races are not statewide races. So your big city in Wisconsin, the Madisons and the Milwaukees can't dominate. They can't throw in 50,000 fraudulent votes in those cities and in a close election and turn the tide, because there's a congressional seat out by La Crosse that the people in Milwaukee and Madison aren't voting for that seat. These are not statewide races. Senate are statewide races. So for that reason, it would be infinitesimally more difficult for Democrats to cheat in these congressional races. So for sure we get back to House of Representatives, which that puts a block in D.C. from any legislation. Likely they think the Senate will flip too. So we've got that minimum, the block of Joe Biden. And then I think there's the potential to impeach him. I mean, there's so much dissatisfaction with Joe Biden. They could impeach him if they've got the House and the Senate. But then that would leave you with Kamala. And so a completely eviscerated Biden might be better than Kamala. I don't think they could just impeach Biden and then turn around and impeach Kamala. I mean, maybe they could, but Republicans, they're not, even Trump Republicans, if they take over the House, I just don't think they have the balls to do that. So at a minimum, we've got a block from any legislation federally. And then, there's all the committees and things like that the Republicans would control in Congress. But I would think that the Senate and the House, they should be able to knock down any executive orders with legislation, because I think there's congressional oversight for most executive orders. And I don't know the mechanism, because if the Senate and the House have oversight over executive orders, which I think they do, they could pass legislation, but then some would say, well, the president would just veto it. Again, I think there must be some kind of congressional oversight for executive orders, because if it wouldn't make sense that would make Joe Biden untouchable. That would make any president untouchable. If they can issue an executive order and then it would take an act of Congress to overturn the executive order, but then the president could overturn that, could veto that, then all you're going to have is a president with unchecked power. So I just can't imagine that I can't imagine that there isn't a mechanism for congressional oversight for executive orders. So I think with the Republican Senate, Republican House, I think that would put everything Joe Biden could do in check, including executive orders. Supreme Court's a wild card because I've been disappointed they haven't taken some cases that we would think they should have. But so that's the first big win I think we're going to see is the midterms don't occur till November, but I think we're going to see as the campaigns start and Democrats, once they get in campaign mode and realize that they have to, and you're already seeing it with some of the things happening in D.C., that there's Democrats hesitant to just follow lockstep. You know, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, he's said he won't support Build Back Bolshevik. I saw that on TV. I thought that was fantastic. The Build Back Better plan, Build Back Bolshevik. Someone paraphrased that on TV. I thought that was funny. Build Back Broke is another characterization, which is good. That's how they need to do this. That's how Republicans need to do the messaging on these things. Instead of always letting the Democrats pick their cutesy names, the Affordable Care Act, and then using it and repeating it over and over. Call it what it is. Make up I've said this before on the show. I've suggested this to Republicans. Make up a name for when they have anytime a Democrat passes some safety bill, call it the freedom infringement, whatever, the criminal empowerment, what, give it a name and call it by that every time you talk about it, instead of using the name that the Democrats assigned to it. Again, Affordable Care Act, Build Back Better, that the infrastructure bill, lets the Democrats dictate the propaganda, and then you turn around and repeat it. So yeah, Build Back Broke, Build Back Bolshevik, that's the things that people need to be doing and characterizing these things as to win. And even win in the public discourse, in the public discussion. But so as soon as this spring, these midterms are going to start really heating up. There's going to be polling. There's going to be all this crap. And then I think the Democrats are really going to be on their best behavior. We're not going to see this kind of radical crap that they were trying to push in the past. It's only been in the past 12 months since Biden was inaugurated. So that's the first wins. I think we're going to start to experience the feelings of winning, because even though those don't occur till November, effect of those campaigns being underway, I think, is going to be felt far sooner. Truth Social. This is Trump's, I think this is going to be one of the biggest impacts of the year. This is Trump's social media company. It's already valued at over $1 billion. It's going to happen. It's going to be big. It's going to rival Facebook. And I think it will likely unseat Facebook. I would not want to be an investor in Facebook right now with all the stuff that they're known for, the censorship, the deplatforming, the algorithmic, the shadow banning, the algorithmic manipulation. Who would want to be on Facebook? As soon as there is a legit alternative, and unfortunately, like MeWe wasn't it, started to be like right away, but then when people, I think MeWe's best days were like November of 2020, right after the presidential election, because there was a lot of people flocking to MeWe, and I think a lot of that's when the deplatforming started. And I think a lot of conservatives thought they were going to be deplatformed at any moment. So a lot of people I know like signed up for MeWe, like flocking to MeWe. And then after a month and they realized that and Facebook realized we can't keep deplatforming. We can't keep banning Republicans, conservatives, or we're not going to have a constituency left. They realized that was a bad, so they deplatformed the most impactful that they could, which is what I got deplatformed. But yeah, that was MeWe's heyday, is right after the election when people, even people who are still on Facebook, they thought they were going to be deplatformed. So they signed up for a MeWe account. And then when they realized then they go back to Facebook and they end up not getting banned. They learn to, you know, not say the naughty things, not talk about the naughty things like support for Kyle Rittenhouse, not talk about the naughty things like ivermectin. You know, they get conditioned to behave, and then they realize that they can survive on the big elephant on Facebook. Well, when Truth Social comes out, I mean, people are going to flock to it. It's going to be huge. All the conservatives are going to go there. And then the liberals are going to follow, because liberals don't like to live in their own stench. This has been true in real life. When I say real life, like in the physical reality, it's just been true everywhere. Liberals ruin places, and then they turn around and go where the conservatives leave and go elsewhere. And then the liberals turn around and go where the conservatives go, because they don't want to live in their own shit either. So Truth Social is going to be big. You're going to be able to speak freely again. You're going to be able to use social media for Republican, you're going to be able to use social media for conservative activism. Right now, you can't really, I mean, on a small, small scale, you can use, but it's really, you really can't, because even like you talk to anybody, you talk to whether it's a conservative talk show host, you talk to whoever, they will tell you that even their social media, they've been shadow banned. They weren't flat out banned from social media, but their posts just don't get the exposure. Dan O'Donnell on WISN talks about this, how he used to post something and it would get 3,000 shares within 24 hours. And now he posts something and he gets 100 shares in 24 hours, something that would even be more interesting that would he would expect more shares from. That's Facebook using their logarithms to not show his stuff in people's news feeds. Once you have a social media platform, so conservatives, even if they're not kicked off social media, conservative groups like Wisconsin Carry. Wisconsin Carry isn't kicked off of Facebook. There's still a Wisconsin Carry Facebook page, obviously. But it's shadow banned. I guarantee that when someone would post something, and I'm not on anymore, but when before all the logarithmic manipulation by Facebook, when someone would, when I would post something on Wisconsin Carry, it would show up in a very, very large number of Wisconsin Carry members' Facebook feeds. After the shadow banning, someone posts something in Wisconsin Carry, it doesn't show up on people's news feeds. People kind of have to go to the page to see it, or a very, very few, because they couldn't show it to no one. Then it would really be obvious what they're doing. So social media has lost its effectiveness for conservatives. Because even if you're not banned from it, the power of the network doesn't work because they use that logarithmic manipulation. That's not going to be the case on Truth Social. Truth Social, not only can you say things that you would get banned from Facebook or put in Facebook jail or censored from Facebook for saying, you'll be able to say those things. And then also, you're not going to have this shadow banning. You're not going to have this logarithmic manipulation to make to suppress the spread of things that you post, things that you share. And so that's something that's going to be profound with social media and with Truth Social from Trump. And I mean, I'm telling you, that's going to be huge. I've heard that something's going to launch in January. See, originally I heard it was next fall, and then now I'm hearing something's going to launch in January. So I also read somewhere that the beta testing, like for certain people, the beta testing is already taking place with Truth Social, that started in November, like to invited, you know, guests, invited special people that are beta doing the beta testing for Truth Social. So yeah, it's going to be awesome. It's going to be impactful. We're going to win again. And I'm super excited because we're going to get our voice back. We're going to get our ability to, it's been such asymmetrical warfare. It's not even been like fighting with one hand tied behind your back. It's been like fighting with both hands tied behind your back and blindfold. It's been like Democrats have been able to play dirty and get away with it, riot, loot, and murder and get away with it. And Republicans haven't even been able to open their mouths and, quote, get away with it. So with Truth Social, the tables are going to be turned. The Facebooks and the YouTubes, they're going to have to end their practices of manipulation in order to survive. And I don't think they can. Well, no, they're going to survive. But I truly think Truth Social is going to be the, well, it's going to be the next big thing for sure. I think it's going to unseat Facebook. I think it will become the go-to platform, certainly for conservatives, and who gives a fuck about the liberals. But so, yeah, I think that whenever that launches, that's going to be a mega game changer. I would think they would want that thing to launch before the midterms. I would think that I would think that Trump would want that. Now, obviously, it's a big thing to build out all the infrastructure between servers and programming and all that stuff. I mean, it's a security model. It's a huge endeavor. So they can't launch it before it's bulletproof. But I would think that they would be doing everything they can to get that thing functional by the election season. So again, I would think that early spring, they would want to have that thing up and running for its utility for the election purposes, because the midterms are super important to Trump to get those people in so that when he gets elected president again, he's got a Congress that he can work with to get this country back from over the cliff of communism. So I'm excited. I feel like Wisconsin Carry. Oh, speaking of which, expect an email from me. I set up Wisconsin Carry. I've been thinking about doing this for months. I didn't have a lot to say. These things bill by the month, and just to save money, I didn't start it. I just signed. I migrated Wisconsin Carry's previous email list over to MailerLite, and I'm now able to send out mass emails like I used to years and years and years ago. I don't think Wisconsin Carry has used mass email since probably 2013, 14-ish. ListBox went out of business, and I know it's been years. Probably been at least 5 years since we got dependent on Facebook. It was so much easier to just post up on Facebook versus go send this. But I think that Facebook only had about a 10% reach. Any given post, 12,000 members, about 10% would actually get the post, would actually see it. Whereby with email, I think the open rate, from what I've seen, what I remember, is closer to 80%. So I think getting back to email will be a much more effective communication tool. Wisconsin Carry's got some great things going. We've got the oral arguments that were heard in the Dubik case, which is going to be super impactful here in Wisconsin. We've got other cases that are on appeal at the Seventh Circuit. I think it's going to be a great year for Wisconsin Carry. And again, I feel like it's been very, very, very difficult to operate Wisconsin Carry in the past couple of years, but I think that's about to change with Truth Social, with getting back to using email. I'm just super excited because I think it's like getting your, not your mojo back, but kind of. I mean, it's getting your ability to be impactful back, getting your ability to efficate change. And that's just, to me, super thrilling because the last few years, I felt like I didn't have that ability, really the last year and a half since being banned from social media. It's been difficult to be impactful with Wisconsin Carry. How do I get information out quickly and to people? And that's about to change. I'm super excited. Next thing I was going to talk about tonight was the flu is the new COVID. And I'm telling you, mark my words with this, the flu is the new COVID. There was an AP story. I picked this story up off of Spectrum News 1. And so, but it was being an AP story means that it was reported on all kinds of other news outlets would have picked it up as well. I'm just waiting for the link to open here. So this story was on Spectrum News 1, but it's an AP story. And the headline is, flu is making a comeback in U.S. after an unusual year off. Right there, I'm going to take issue, but here's the quote. The U.S. flu season has arrived on schedule after taking a year off, with flu hospitalizations rising and 2 child deaths reported. Last year's flu season was the lowest on record, likely because COVID-19 measures, school closures, distancing, masks, and canceled travel prevented the spread of influenza, or because the coronavirus somehow pushed aside other viruses. Now, okay. That's the quote from this article. Now, first again, we can go right back to April, March of 2020, when I made predictions about coronavirus that have been proven true, whether it was that masks don't work, whether it was that you – remember back in 2020 in March and April, they said, well, we don't know if you'll have immunity. We don't know if you get COVID, you might be able to get it again right away. We don't know if you'll have immunity, which was bunk. I knew that you would have immunity from COVID if you got it, because every other virus in the history of man that didn't kill you would give you immunity. That's how you – if it didn't kill you, you recovered from it. Your body, your immune system overcame it. You have immunity to it. So when they were saying, oh, well, and it was the news, well, we don't know. We don't yet know if you're going to be immune from COVID. No, we did know. We did know you would be immune from COVID. And I said that in March and April of 2020 when the news was all saying, well, we don't know. We don't know. You might be able to get COVID right away again after. I said, no, bullshit. And again, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. I'm just a guy with a fucking brain. So now we got the flu season here thing that, oh, the return of the flu season. And we've got this story. Now, again, not a doctor, not a scientist. I'm a guy with a damn brain. And I can read this. And you, some of you probably can too. And immediately pick out the flu season. I'm going to read the quote again. The U.S. flu season has arrived on schedule after taking a year off. Bullshit. The flu did not take a year off. Look, I had last year, I got sick twice. I think the first time was in 2020. I got sick twice. I think in 2020. In March 2020 is when I had COVID. I think I had it from the first wave. And then I got some kind of virus again in the fall of 2020. So I think I had the flu last year or something very viral. The flu didn't take a year off. My fiance, she worked in the ER. They stopped testing for the flu in 2020. In 2020, you came in with flu-like symptoms. They tested you for COVID. They didn't even run the influenza A and influenza B tests on you. So when they say here in this article, the U.S. flu season has arrived on schedule after taking a year off, with flu hospitalizations rising and two child deaths reported. Last year's flu season was the lowest on record. And they say, this is the two reasons they give. They said it was the lowest on record, likely because COVID-19 measures, school closures, distancing, masks, and canceled travel, prevented the spread of the flu, or because the coronavirus somehow pushed aside other viruses. They don't even include the other or is that the flu season didn't take a year off. The reason that last year's flu season was the lowest on record because they didn't test for it. If you don't test for the flu, because those reports get sent to the CDC, it's like a crime that doesn't get reported to the police. If someone robs someone in an alley, and the person that gets robbed doesn't call the police and doesn't file a police report, that robbery never occurred in the eyes of statistics, in the eyes of the criminal justice system, in the eyes of the FBI, because they track these statistics. If you didn't test for the flu, and remember there was people that came in with flu-like symptoms and then they tested negative for COVID, and they said, oh, well, you must have COVID. Test them again. They just kept testing you until you get a positive test. And knowing those tests weren't 100%, they just kept testing until you got a false positive and said, no, they're COVID. Trust me, not a doctor, not a scientist. I guarantee the flu last year was not the lowest on record. The flu last year was the lowest reported on record because they stopped testing for it. I know for a fact they stopped testing for it because my fiance worked in the ER and she said, yeah, we didn't even test for the flu last year. Any other year you come in with flu-like symptoms, we're going to test you for the flu. Last year, they didn't do it. They were just testing for COVID. And again, people who had the flu, they were likely coded, C-O-D-E-D, like when you code a crime in the crime statistics, in the codes that they use for medical records keeping. They were likely coding the flu as COVID. Why? Because hospitals got paid for treating people with COVID. Remember the federal government was throwing around money. Anybody, if you were treating someone for COVID, I think it was like $30,000. You treat someone for COVID, it was $8,000. You hospitalize, $8,000. They go on a ventilator, $30,000. I mean, it was massive, massive, massive money for COVID. There was no massive, massive, massive money for the flu. Why would a hospital want to code someone? Why would they want to test you for the flu and say you have the flu when they don't get a damn penny for the flu? But COVID means thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. The flu didn't take the year off last year. Here's the other thing. School closures, social distancing, masks, canceled travel, prevented the flu. If any of those things work, the flu is an airborne respiratory virus. COVID is an airborne respiratory virus. If school closures, distancing, masks, and canceled travel prevented the spread of the flu, it would have prevented the spread of COVID. Because they're both airborne upper respiratory viruses. And if any of those things worked for the flu, they would have worked for COVID too, and they didn't. How could those measures work so well against one airborne respiratory virus, but not work against, how could all those measures work magically, like virtually eliminating the flu? How could masks, school closures, social distancing, canceled travel, how could that eradicate the flu, but not even touch COVID? They're both airborne respiratory viruses. Me a break. Makes no sense. I'm not a scientist, but I can think. And for the record, I and many others have been right about more since the start of this scamdemic than the experts on TV. There's been so many lies, we've forgotten many of them. Masks. First, Fauci said they don't work multiple times, and then he said that they do work. Remember coronavirus on surfaces? When coronavirus first came out, oh, it lives on surfaces for 28 days, and then, oh, later, oh, it's typically not transmitted from touching. I already mentioned this a couple minutes ago. First, they said, we don't know if you're immune once you get it, which is just garbage, because every respiratory virus in the history of mankind, you develop immunity to when you recover. You've got the antibody immunity, then the T-cell immunity. Antibody immunity is kind of like active water on a fire, like a sprinkler system that's operating. T-cell immunity is kind of like a fire suppression system that's ready to go the minute it smells smoke. If you never dove into this before, after an initial infection with a novel virus, it kind of sneaks past your body's defenses and infects cells and then replicates. That's how viruses work. And by the time your body realizes, oh shit, this thing wasn't supposed to be here, it's very widespread in your body. Then your body produces active antibodies. Antibodies make your blood very viscous, but your body can't keep producing antibodies for every kind of virus you've ever encountered. So instead, it stops producing active antibodies. But your T cells remember the antibodies it had to produce the last time it encountered that particular virus, that it was stimulated by a virus. And the next time your cells encounter the same virus, they block it at the cellular level because they recognize, oh, we're not going to let this virus attach and replicate in our cell because we know last time we got really sick from that. But that's how your immune system works. That's where the old phrase comes, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So again, this notion that we could virtually eradicate the flu, an airborne respiratory virus, but we couldn't even stem the tide of another airborne respiratory virus, COVID, that's so illogical, it's laughable. But this isn't the first reporting like that. It's everywhere. Fake news. It's complete storytelling. But again, anybody with the brain should be able to turn on, and here's Spectrum News 1, and this is an AP story, so it's run all across the country, with just this utter bullshit, this completely fiction about the flu being eradicated last year. That is absolute garbage. An honest report would say we now have documented cases of the flu because we've been testing for them. There's got to be a stat somewhere. How many flu tests were given last year? They've got to be able to track that somewhere. And the number, I'll bet you, is just an honest fraction of what they would have in any previous year. An absolute fraction. And that's the reason why there was no flu season last year, because we didn't test for it. So sticking with the coronanoia narrative here, just this changing narrative and twisting statistics of COVID stuff. So this was an interesting And again, just critical thinking here, using your brain. There's another story from Spectrum News 1 in Milwaukee. Although Spectrum News 1, I think, is a statewide media entity. It's the media, the news station for, oh, come on, let me, I'm trying to get my story to pop up here. Here it is. Okay. So Spectrum News 1, which I think is a statewide news arm of Spectrum Cable. Headline, study, Johnson & Johnson booster, 85% effective against hospitalizations. That's the headline. Reading from this article, a real-world study of healthcare workers in South Africa found that a booster dose of the Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine was 85% effective at preventing COVID-19-related hospitalizations, demonstrating strong protectiveness against the Omicron variant. The study looked at 69,000 healthcare workers between November 15th and December 20, when the Omicron variant was prevalent in the country. The study showed that protection rose significantly after receiving a second dose of J&J, from 63% within 13 days of getting the second shot to 84% at 14 to 27 days, and 85% 1 to 2 months post-boost. Data from the study confirm that the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 booster shot provides 85% effectiveness against hospitalization in areas where Omicron is dominant, says the global head of Janssen Research and Development. Now, here's the thing. You just read that and you think, oh, awesome. J&J vaccine is 85% effective against hospitalizations. But I say, how so? There's a lot missing from that. How could that be measured? Does that mean that of the people who got the J&J vaccine, only 15% ended up in the hospital? See, that might sound great. You might say, hey, here's what you say. Oh, if I take the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, I've only got a 15% chance of getting hospitalized. Again, that might sound great until you realize that 15% of people who get COVID don't end up hospitalized anyway. Stated differently, the hospitalization rate for people who get COVID is not 15%. So how do they know who would have been hospitalized? And again, I read a couple paragraphs from this article. How do they know who would have been hospitalized? Something just doesn't smell right with this article, but this is just your typical statistic twisting in the news media. It seems more like this article in Spectrum News 1 is just a sales and marketing piece for Johnson & Johnson intended to drive Johnson & Johnson demand. Everybody reads it, oh, let's go get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine because that gives you 85% protection. You're 85% protected from hospitalization. Again, that would mean that you're 15% not protected if you're not vaccinated at all. The hospitalization rate for COVID is not 15%. If the hospitalization rate for COVID for the unvaccinated was 15%, I mean, I think the other day there was 500,000 people that got COVID in one day. If the hospitalization rate was, and that was nationwide, but if 500,000 people times 0.15, that would mean 75,000 people per day are getting hospitalized. If there's a 50, that's not even close to that. I don't know what the hospitalization rate for COVID really is. I should have Googled that. I probably could have. That stat's got to be out there. But for all the people that get COVID, the hospitalization rate is probably around 1%, 2%, 3%, you know, something like that. I would say for sure probably less than 5%. So when it sounds, oh, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine gives you 85% effectiveness against hospitalization, I can't imagine how that could be proven in a legitimate way. I can imagine that they can say, hey, 85% of the people, because that's what they said. They looked at 69,000 healthcare workers between November 15th and December 20th when the Omicron variant was prevalent in the country. And the study showed that protection rose significantly after receiving a second dose of J&J. Now, they don't even say, they just say protection rose significantly after receiving a second dose of J&J from 63% within 63% protection. What does that mean? Does that mean within the first 13 days, people that get COVID, only 63% of people that got COVID didn't get hospitalized? At 14 to 27 days, 84% of the people that had that booster shot didn't get hospitalized after getting COVID. It just, you know, this article seems like nothing but propaganda. And there's no journalistic curiosity here on behalf of these. Here it says, results from the study have yet to be published in a peer-reviewed journal, but have been submitted to the preprint server MedRxiv by the study's authors. In years past, you would have been more skeptical about the conspiracy theory that someone would be, that Johnson & Johnson would just try to get this article published just to drive their sales of their vaccine. But now, I mean, that doesn't even seem like as much of a conspiracy theory as it seems very logical that that would be something that is going to take place, given everything else that we've seen. The next story I was going to do about this changing narrative with COVID, sticking with the COVID thing, was a local story. A couple months back, there was all these news stories. I'm sure you heard them like I did, where they said, oh, the vast majority of people are, the vast majority of hospitalizations are unvaccinated. That's what we kept hearing. The vast majority of hospitalizations are unvaccinated. A couple months ago, I saw it. Aurora was saying that 80%+ of their hospitalizations were unvaccinated. But now there was just an article in the Milwaukee Business Journal that said, with Advocate Aurora said it has about three times more COVID-19 patients at its 26 hospitals across Illinois and Wisconsin than it did just 8 weeks ago, which was the highest so far in 2021. As a result, beds are filling up and wait times can be long, the advertisement states. The strain on our front line is undeniable. The doctors, nurses, and countless others who have so skillfully and compassionately cared for our communities are hurting. Advocate Aurora said more than 90% of all, here's the money line. And remember, a couple months ago, Advocate Aurora said 80%+ of their hospitalizations were unvaccinated, which means that 20% were vaccinated. But now Aurora Advocate says that 90% of all COVID inpatients are unvaccinated or due for a booster. So now they're adding those due for a booster, because now they've obviously got a lot of people in the hospital who were vaccinated. So their statistic of 80% of the hospitalizations were unvaccinated, those statistics aren't holding true. So now they have to say, oh, well, 90% of all patients are unvaccinated or due for a booster. First we're told that vaccines are 85% effective. Excuse me, we're 95%. First, we're told that vaccines are 95% effective preventing COVID infection. And then the vaccinated all still get COVID. And then, so the next thing they said was, oh, no, the vaccines will keep you from getting hospitalized. But now the vaccinated are still getting hospitalized. So now they blame hospitalizations on not being boosted. I mean, just the lies that get proven wrong 2 months later, and then they give you more lies, and then those are proven wrong 2 months later, so they give you more lies. It's honestly amazing to me that they even have the audacity to make comments like this, to make public statements like this, to say that 90% of all COVID patients are unvaccinated or due for a booster. Just, they must think that you're stupid. They must think, and let's be honest, a lot of people probably don't look beyond that headline they say, oh yeah, 90% of patients are unvaccinated or due for a booster. Honestly, most people probably don't even hear the due for a booster part. But if you really read this stuff, you can easily analyze and pick apart the truth. I'm not even sure anymore if I was open to the thought, and maybe even thought maybe it was likely that vaccinated people were unlikely to be hospitalized. But from what I'm seeing now, statistics from other countries, and now what's happening in this country, I wouldn't even put stock in that. I'm curious. I don't even know if we ever get a true accounting of these vaccines. Honest to God, I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't do a damn thing. With all the people that are vaccinated and that are getting COVID, I wouldn't be surprised if these vaccines don't do a damn thing. That this is just a $1 trillion snake oil sale. So 12 minutes left. The last story I was going to do tonight was just a little, I read an article, and I've always, this is kind of last year's news, this whole Me Too thing that was, you know, that was pre-COVID. Me Too was the big thing pre-COVID. But like most things in life, your problems come from yourself. Like most things in life, you, meaning me or you, are your biggest obstacle to overcome. Your wants, your vices, your bad habits. And in the case of many women who want to go to Hollywood, the biggest problem for them to overcome is their lust for fame. Their lust for fame leads them to do things that they didn't want to do, but they wanted the fame more. So instead of acknowledging their culpability for what happened to them, they blame men, and they blame sexism, and they blame powerful people. Oh, these people have power over others. And it's like, no, honey, you can't resist your own wants and desires. A movie executive, a famous actor, they have no power over you unless your lust for fame is larger than your self-respect. So, story from Fox News. I want to read this article here. It's about Hugh Hefner and the Playboy Mansion. So I'm reading this, and Holly Madison was one of Hugh, is a former Playboy bunny, and she spoke out on the Power Hugh Hefner podcast. So Holly Madison, hang on, I gotta silence my computer here. Holly Madison, this headline, Holly Madison details traumatic first night sleeping with Hugh Hefner. He, quote, was pushed on top of me. Former Playboy bunny spoke out on the Power Hugh Hefner podcast. Read from the article here. Holly Madison is getting, this is from FoxNews.com. Holly Madison is getting candid about what it was really like being one of Hugh Hefner's many girlfriends. The former Playboy bunny recently appeared on Power Hugh Hefner podcast, where she recalled being invited to spend a night out with the magazine publisher, according to the 41-year-old. She was hoping to be invited to live in the Playboy mansion because one of Hugh Hefner's girlfriends had recently left. I didn't really know what went on with them sexually, she claimed. I knew there must be something, and I was prepared for that. I wasn't prepared for what would eventually happen. Madison claimed that after spending some time in a club that night, she went back to the mansion with Hefner, along with some other women they were with. I will quote, I wasn't necessarily expecting to have sex that night, she said. I thought it would be more of a first date, even though obviously it's not a very traditional first date. I thought it would be more the type of thing where I saw what happened, saw what was going on. If I wasn't comfortable with it, I wouldn't have to do anything, and I could make my decision on whether I wanted to come back for date number two or not. The Girls Next Door alum told the outlet that that night didn't go as she imagined. Instead, Madison claimed she and Hefner did have sex. Quote, I definitely was not expecting to be the first one to go that night, but I was wasted, she said, Madison. He was literally pushed on top of me, and after it happened, I was just mortified and embarrassed, and it had way more of an emotional impact on me than I thought it would. Madison said she was horrified by the idea that others knew what happened between them. Quote, I thought he was really smart. I really looked up to him, so I liked him, and it wasn't that the idea of possibly having sex with him repelled me so much. I know that's not relatable to a lot of people because they're like, oh, he's an old man Gross. It was more the group aspect that was really out of my comfort zone and just the feeling of, oh, wow, okay, that happened. Everybody knows it happened, she continued. I kind of all of a sudden felt like everybody was going to know about me, and I was horrified by that. Madison also noted that she felt like she had to stay after that traumatic experience. Now listen to this quote. Madison noted that she felt like she had to stay after that traumatic. She had a traumatic experience, but then she felt like she has to stay. So the next morning, Madison asked Hefner if she could move into the mansion, and he agreed. This is a quote, direct quote from Madison, Holly Madison. I felt like there's no taking that back, so I might as well get what I came for, she said. I felt like by moving myself in and getting what I wanted from the situation, that was demanding respect in a way. I felt like if I didn't do that, I was just going to be haunted by the experience. Now, there you go. It's like, what did you come for, Holly? You came looking for fame, and you were willing to fuck to get it. You wanted the fame and the money, and the only difference between you and a prostitute on the corner is the size of the trick, the dollars. But here's this thing. When these women talk about, now this is her one specific example, but this is so typical of when women go to Hollywood. They're looking for fame. They're looking for fortune. They're looking for their big break. And that's why they end up getting taken advantage of by whether it's movie executives, whether it's, and you realize they, it's not that they get raped in the traditional sense. They consent. They have consensual sex with someone, but they feel their own pressure. They feel their own pressure that if they don't, they're not going to get a big break, get a part, get a whatever. And so then they blame this Hollywood, the Me Too culture, and they blame powerful men. There's no one more. Now, there's women that are legitimately raped. I mean, I think there, you know, we know about, think about a girl, you know, whether it's, here, example, if some actor, I don't want to use an actor, actual actor's name because I don't want to, but some actor, we'll call him Famous Joe. If Famous Joe goes out to dinner with a girl and or meets a girl at a club and says, do you want to come back to my hotel? And Famous Joe takes his girl back to his hotel. Thought I'm going to sneeze here. And then they start making out. She has drinks. They end up having sex. And then the next day she feels, whether because, you know, she didn't get a big break or whatever, she feels somewhat jilted. Then she claims, well, I mean, I didn't say no, but it, you know, so it's not like a criminal case of rape, but this is an example of men abusing their authority over women. And it's like, you know, no, honey, you're the one that couldn't say no. Because if you went there and didn't say no, you can say now, oh, it's because, you know, he was famous and he was, these men have so much power. No, they only have power if you don't. Now, if she goes over to his apartment and they start having drinks, because going to someone's apartment is not consenting to sex. If some girl in a club goes to Famous Joe's apartment and they have drinks and then he starts kissing her and then he starts to pull her pants down and she says no, and then he rips her pants off and rapes her, that, and she's saying no, 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 that's rape. But when Famous Joe invites a girl over to his apartment, they have drinks, and then he starts to take her pants off. She says nothing. She keeps kissing him. She whatever, even if in the back of her head, she's like, I don't really want to do this, but he's Famous Joe. Don't come running to me with your Me Too movement bullshit, because you don't need someone else to, you don't need society to change. You can't ask society to do for you what you wouldn't do for yourself. And this article with Holly Madison, and it is just a perfect example of women that go to Hollywood looking for fame. She says it right in the quote. She knew what happened in the, you know, she knew that you don't go to Hugh Hefner's party or invited to his event and not know. she knew she didn't expect to, you know, necessarily have him forced on her that night. But did she say no? I guarantee not. She went right along with it. They pushed him on top of her or whatever, however it goes. And she just went along with it. She didn't say no. And she could have, because she knew saying no would have meant she's gone. She knew saying no would have meant she goes home. And she couldn't put her self-respect above her desire for fame. That's the problem here. That was the problem. Don't go crying, Me Too. Don't go crying, oh, rich and powerful men. Look in the mirror. And again, I want to read this quote from her again. Holly Madison, I felt like there's no taking that back, meaning the night having sex with Hugh Hefner, so I might as well get what I came for, she said. I felt like by moving myself in and getting what I wanted from the situation, that was demanding respect in some way. She wanted fame. She wanted the big break. She wanted the exposure. She wanted the famous Hollywood lifestyle. That's what she came for. That was getting what she wanted from the situation, and sleeping with Hugh Hefner is what she had to do it. She wanted the fame. She wanted the money. And she was willing to spread her legs for it. Again, the only difference between Holly Madison and a prostitute on the corner is the size of the trick, the dollar payoff. Don't go crying about Me Too. Don't go crying about rich and powerful men when you can't. Now, don't get me wrong. A woman goes out with an actor, famous Joe, goes to dinner. That's not consenting to sex. Lets him buy her dinner. That's not consenting to sex. There's no obligation for sex. Goes back to his apartment and has drinks. That's not consenting to sex. He starts to put his hand down your pants and you don't say no, stop. He takes your pants off and starts having sex. You don't say stop. Sorry, that's consensual sex. And you don't get to blame the rich and powerful. You only get to blame yourself. And again, I know this Me Too thing's a couple years old, but this was just recently, that was just in the Fox News article mid-December. And I thought it's a perfect expose that says what I've said about the whole Me Too thing for a long time. Again, don't get me wrong. There's women that are sexually assaulted, but most of these Me Too things, it's women that couldn't deal with their own lust for fame. And they chose to take part in these things and then for whatever reason regretted it later. But that's not the rich and powerful fault, this woman. So anyway, that's the show for this week. Thanks for tuning in, Lon. Thanks for tuning in, Ralph. Whoever catches us in the podcast, thanks for tuning in. Hope you guys have a great week. We'll probably have a show next week. We'll see what we get for content this upcoming week. But you guys have a great week. Carry on and be well armed.
Chick Julie, you've been listening to Well Armed Radio, and I have to know, is that a gun in your pants, or did you just really enjoy the show?
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.